Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloud and Out podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig. We have been building on AWS since 2009. Follow along in our journey building products like BucketEV, Marbot, and HyperAnv, and learn from our practice. This is episode number 83. We are recording this on November 16th in 2023. In case you're watching this live on either YouTube or LinkedIn, feel free to ask your questions and we will answer them during the show. So, Andreas, what was a topic that you worked on in the last, I think it was weeks? So what did you learn while working with AWS?
Yeah, Michael. So I was working on a relatively easy sounding task, actually. So the idea is, so BucketEV, our solution to scan S3 buckets for malware, was using instance types like M5, T3, and customers were asking about, they wanted to use the newer instance families like an M7i, M7a, or something like that. And so the task on our Trello board was was actually quite simple. So just add the new instance families and allow customers to use it. But as always, when you dive into things, it gets a little more complicated. And the thing is here, so we sell BucketEV for customers in all commercial AWS regions, so 28 regions, when I have that in my head correctly. So the thing is, we have to ensure that our solution works in all of those regions. And therefore, I checked which instance families, which instance types are actually available in all the regions. And to do so, I've written a small script to get all that information out of the AWS API. Because, Michael, do you have a guess how many EC2 instance families and instance types AWS offers those days?
So it's a lot. So I would say over 100 families and maybe 600 instance types.
Yeah, you're relatively close. So it's 116 instance families, and those families altogether consist of 761 instance types. So this is quite a lot. So I had a script running, and this was basically checking which of those instance families is available in which region. And here's what I found out. So the first thing, that's maybe what you would have expected, but there's only one region that supports all the instance types. And of course, this is the largest, oldest US East 1 region. So if you really want to use all the available instance types, that's the only region you can choose. And then what's also maybe interesting is there are only a few instance families that are available in all the regions. So this is the fifth generation C5, M5, R5, then the T3 and T4G instance types. So those are the things that are available in all regions, and then the I3 instance families as well. So 12 instance families only that you can pick in all the regions. So for BucketEV, formerly we used the M5 and T3 instance types only, and they are available in all regions, actually. So now, as we are adding more instance families, they are no longer available in all the regions. So that is what I found out. And then the next thing that I found from my data is that new regions, they support only a small subset of the available instance types, instance families. So for example, Asia Pacific Southeast 4 only provides 30% of the instance families. So we can see that basically AWS is rolling out the instance families to new regions very slowly, very gradually.
So Andreas, did you say 13%?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not a lot.
No, that's basically the default ones that I talked about, and then a few of the newer ones, and then that's it. Yeah. I will link the blog post that I published yesterday, which contains even more fine granular information. So if you want to look which instance types are available in which regions, and check out that blog post. It contains tables and all the numbers that I talked you through. I found that kind of interesting. And the challenge is really if you, so from the one side, it's very cool that we can use AWS to deploy our infrastructure to data centers all around the world. But there's also a complexity with that because the regions are not 100% the same. So we talked about that many times, but the instance types is another example where they differentiate from each other.
Yeah, I can add one example of such a like inconsistency between regions that I remember. This was also like discovered by developing BucketEV because we have a test that basically spins up our product in all the regions. And in two regions, it was failing, like two new regions. And the error was that there was something around a spot allocation strategy was not yet supported in that region. So that was really a very, very tiny feature of an auto-scaling group was missing. And I was not aware that such a thing can actually happen. But that was really a bummer. And one thing, another aspect, Andreas, that I want to add is your kind of statistic that you created over the instance families and types is kind of on a region scope, right? But what we also discovered is that in some availability zones, instance types are missing, which is completely crazy. So, for example, in US East 1, there are availability zones that are missing instance types that are available in other availability zones. So this is really, then it really gets crazy, right? So, I mean, you deploy the solution in two accounts and because of this way that how availability zones are assigned so that they kind of randomly kind of assign the letters A, B, C, it is possible that in one account you can deploy the solution, in another account it's not working. And you have very little control over that, actually. So that's also something that kind of a headache that you might run into when you deploy your solution into multiple regions and things like that. Yeah, but as you said, the picture is actually quite clear. So newer regions have cause more troubles than older ones, basically. And yeah, choose the region wisely, basically, is the advice, right, Andreas?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, when we did consulting work back in the days, Andreas, like we had customers, like there was a region opening in Germany, which was like, because we are based in Germany, this was like a big thing for lots of German customers of AWS. So they were all kind of jumping to migrate to Frankfurt. And I mean, they were running into all those problems. And there was even capacity shortages and stuff like that compared to the Ireland region, which is kind of the US East 1 region of Europe. So that's the biggest region here. And I mean, if you started there, then you have basically everything available. And then you kind of moved into a region where there was basically just a subset available. So that just, sorry. So I just remembered that. Okay. So I was also working on an aspect that covers BucketEV, but it does not only apply to our BucketEV antivirus Amazon S3 solution, kind of what you said before. So you kind of worked on BucketEV, but the result applies to other workloads as well. So I constantly check the AWS blogs and the what's new feed to just kind of keep myself up to date with all the changes. And there was one item popping into my RSS reader, which is titled Amazon Connect now enables scanning of attachments for malware. And because of our work with BucketEV, whenever I read scanning attachment malware, so I'm alerted because that's kind of what we do as well. So I was looking into that, and before I read the description, I was just assuming that okay, Amazon Connect now scans the files. That's kind of what the title says, but I soon learned that I have to read more carefully, Andreas. So because it actually says that Amazon Connect now enables scanning. So it doesn't scan, it just enables the scanning. So what does it mean? It means that Amazon Connect now has an integration point where they invoke your Lambda function before the attachment is actually made available. So this is what they actually offer, an integration point. And that sounded like a challenge, right? Because we have the scanning capabilities already in BuckDB, and I thought, okay, it shouldn't be too hard to plug that in. So I looked into the details, and it turns out that what happens is that Amazon Connect, you can configure it to basically provide an Amazon resource name of a Lambda function. And then Amazon Connect will invoke that function, and they have a predefined event schema that they send into your function, and it contains all kinds of metadata, including an S3 bucket and an S3 key. So this is the storage place where the file is stored on an Amazon S3 bucket. So that's really straightforward for us in BuckDB because we already can do that. We can scan files on S3. So that was kind of easy. The thing that caused some more thinking on my side is that what they do is they invoke this Lambda function synchronously. And they wait for up to 16 seconds for the result. And if things go wrong, so if you the function throws an error, they retry for 3 times. The problem is the synchronous part, and I will talk about that in a second. The response that is expected basically is kind of a JSON structure where you provide a value of approved or rejected. And if you say this is approved, then the attachment is kind of made available to the other party. And if you say it's rejected, then the attachment will be kind of blocked. So that's kind of it from a technical perspective. So as I already said, two kind of approaches clash. So Amazon Connect uses the synchronous approach, while BuckDB uses an asynchronous approach. So with BuckDB, you send a scan job to an SQS queue and you get the result on an SNS topic. And in between, there's basically no waiting. You are just informed by the event on the SNS topic. So how can I kind of make this two, or kind of unite those two words? And I mean, the short answer is there is no good solution. There is a solution, and this is what I think I call busy polling. So what I did is I have a Lambda function that connects to our SNS topic, and this basically persists the scan result in a DynamoDB table with a very short time to live. So I have 120 seconds. And then on the other side, in my Lambda function that is invoked by Amazon Connect in a synchronous way, I basically every second I check the DynamoDB table if there is an item for my file ID. and once there is an item, then I look into the DynamoDB item and then I decide if it's clean or infected. I mean, this is not efficient because you pay for the Lambda function invocation time. But in this use case, I mean, the number of files that are uploaded is not, I mean, that's not millions, right? So that's probably hundreds or thousands a day. So assuming that I think a good enough solution to make it work. And that's what I did. It works. We already shipped the feature for our BuckDB customers. And I also wrote a blog post for Cloud and Out, and we will release that next week because Andreas already has his EC2 instance types blog post released this week. So I will release that next week. It shows the code, the Lambda function code, as well as the CDK code to deploy everything. So if you are interested in that, if you're an Amazon Connect user, you can check that out, and you can replicate it even if you're not using BuckDB. So it works with other scan solutions.
Michael, I think that's really cool, and I'm really proud that you were able to deliver that feature 2 days after the announcement from AWS. So this is really cool. So now Amazon Connect users can make sure that when users chatting with their agents in their support center can check uploaded attachments for malware. I think that's really cool. And are you aware of any other provider that already integrated with Amazon Connect?
I have not seen anything, but I mean, I'm not watching them so closely that I would notice that within a couple of hours, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, so I have one more topic. One other thing I came across is called the S3 object lock. This has been around for quite a while. So the idea is that you configure an S3 bucket so that data can only be written once, and you ensure that data cannot be deleted or manipulated later. So that is an important feature of storage, for example, to comply with legal requirements to keep data for specific time periods and to ensure no one can modify that data in this time. So to enable S3 object lock, one requirement is you need to enable S3 bucket versioning. When you do that, enable S3 bucket versioning, then that means when you upload a new version of an object, S3 will also keep the old one. So this is one effect. So you're just keeping all the versions of each object. And if you delete an object, basically everything that happens is a delete marker is stored under the object key. The data, the versions are still available and you can go back to them if you want to. So that is a requirement, the versioning for object lock. And then you can enable the object lock configure that on the bucket. And there are two modes. So one is the governance mode and one is the compliance mode. The governance mode means you can still delete an object version, but only if you have additional IAM actions in the policies attached to your IAM user role or group. The compliance mode means no one, not even the root account, the root user account of the AWS account, can then delete data or rewrite data. So that's maybe interesting. So be careful when you work with that option, because you could run into problems that you are not able to delete data and you have to pay for the storage in that time. Okay, be careful with that. And then when you use object lock, you basically configure the retention period that you want to enable this object lock for. And you can do that either on the bucket level. So for all the objects that are getting uploaded to the bucket, you can define a default, or you can define it when creating the object, putting the object into the bucket. So both is possible. So when you do that, when object lock is enabled for an object, then you can still delete an object, because everything that happens is it creates a delete marker, so the data is still around. But if you try then to delete the object version, so the actual data, then you get an access denied. So this is no longer possible. And to ensure that users are really using the object retention configuration, you should then use a bucket policy that requires all data to use a specific retention period. You can even, so that might be even a thing to configure for the whole account, to make sure that you cannot choose a retention period of 100 years for the data you're storing. So to protect you from running into issues, that might be even a actually an interesting idea that came to my mind right now. So maybe something you can do in large organizations to prevent an accidental use of object locks as well. So you can basically specify a range of the allowed retention period in days in an IAM policy or resource policy. Yeah.
When you say retention period, Andreas, sorry. When you say retention period, that's the retention period for the object lock, right? It's not for the object itself. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there are basically, you can do both, right? So there's also for the data itself, you can delete it after a while, but that's something different here. It's only the object lock. This expires after that time span. So for example, if you are forced to keep the data for 10 years and afterwards it's okay to delete it, then you can configure that in that way. Yeah. So that is a kind of cool feature. So I had a look into it in more detail while answering a support request, and I didn't know about all those details, so I was learning something new while working on that as well.
I mean, there's one question that I have, Andreas, and I don't expect you to answer it actually, but I mean, you said that if the compliance mode, not even the root user can delete it, but what happens if I delete the account? Will they basically pause it until all objects are expired? Or will they just delete the account?
It's a very good question. We should ask someone from AWS to answer that question. Or maybe it's somewhere in the documentation. Yeah, I will try.
Because I mean, if I have root user access, right, I can just delete the whole account. So that
maybe, yeah.
If I want to get rid of the DNS.
That's okay. A very good question. Maybe you find the loophole in all the whole system. Okay, let's try to figure that out until the next episode.
I think I have a good solution, Andreas. I think we can introduce a new feature of AWS that's called account lock.
Account lock, yes. You're right, yeah.
So I think that's good for the feature count, right? So let's just add an account lock. Okay, so maybe it's already solved the problem, right? If anyone knows, let us know. But that's kind of an interesting situation. So last but not least, Andreas, I think we launched or we worked on a new product, and I don't know if you actually talked about it much, but it's called Attachment AV, and it is not AWS related, actually. I mean, it runs on AWS, but it solves a different problem. And the problem that it solves at the moment is that it protects Jira and Confluence workloads from malware. So basically, whenever you upload a file to Jira or Confluence, it will scan that file. So it's kind of similar to what BucketDB does, right? But it works for Atlassian products. And what we already did and what we implemented and what a couple of customers are already using is exactly this kind of feature set. And what we are looking for is feedback from users of the product. And we are hoping that someone that is an AWS user out there that's listening to our podcast might already be an Atlassian user. And if that's you, and if you are a Jira Confluence admin, so if you have permissions to install an app, please reach out to us. You can use the email address hello@attachmentav.com, and I will paste that into the chat in a second. And let us know that you're interested. And what we provide you in response is a 6-month free version of the app for as many users as you have in your Jira or Confluence instance. And it only works for Confluence Cloud, so that's something I have to add as well. And then you can try it out. And all we basically want is feedback on the existing features and the missing features, because we want to kind of improve the product, and therefore we need some feedback from users, actually. And we hope that someone out there is interested in that. So if that's you, please let us know, and we will make sure that we set up everything for you so that it works.
So Michael, there's Wolfgang in the chat has mentioned that DynamoDB has a similar feature with the TTL field. Yes, that is true. So we're basically mixing different things here. So S3 has the retention period for objects, that it deletes an object after a certain amount of time. DynamoDB has the TTL field that you can configure for a table, which will also then delete an item from a table. And then the object lock retention period is basically the time span that you cannot delete a certain object version from S3. So those are the available features. And I think from my experience, these are kind of useful features, because being able to get rid of old data automatically is always a cool thing to do if it's possible, because you're not then piling up data. And also comply with data privacy laws and so on. So when you build a system, always think about that. How long do I have to keep the data? And if you have to ensure that you keep it for a certain time span, use the object lock. But then also think about how to delete all data automatically. And then with Dynamo TTL or S3 retention period for objects, those are features that are really simplifying that, because going through large lists of data in tables or S3 buckets is expensive and complicated as well. So try to avoid that. Yeah, that's a very good hint from Wolfgang. Thank you for that.
Andreas, I can maybe add one thing there. So I think we have a couple of minutes left, right? So I can expand on that. So what you said, basically, and I will apply to the real world. So we have a product called Marbot. And we have exactly the same problem, right? I mean, Marbot is a product where you send alerts to Marbot and it distributes them to Slack or Teams. And what we do out of the box is every alert that comes in is deleted from our database after 14 days. So we just remove it from the database, from DynamoDB, using the TTL feature. And what we can't delete automatically after TTL is, for example, the data about the Slack team. So we have to keep that. And also for the Slack channels and Microsoft Teams channels, for example, or Teams. And what we do to delete them is actually much more complicated because we don't know how many channels actually are used. So we cannot run this in a Lambda function and just loop over all the channels in a Lambda function and hope that it works within 300 seconds, right? So what we do is we spin up a step function. So when you basically uninstall our product, we spin up a step function. And the step function goes and deletes all this data that cannot be deleted with a TTL. And this is really, like, if you look at the code, like, this is much more complex than just deleting it after 14 days. So as you said, if you can, just delete the data automatically after a certain amount of time, because that's kind of implemented by AWS, right? So we don't have to care about that.
Yeah, very good, yeah. Okay, Michael, so maybe one thing before we close this episode. So reInvent is around the corner, and I'm already getting excited about all the new pre-announcements that are coming in my RSS feed those days. So I'm looking forward to reInvent. Unfortunately, neither of us will fly to Vegas this year, so we are watching this remotely from here. We will definitely discuss some of the things in the next episodes, yeah, wish you fun if you're traveling to reInvent, and also looking for all the announcements going on. And as a company that is building products around the AWS ecosystem, we are also a little frightened that one of the announcements will replace one of our products. But let's see, and hope for the best.
Let's hope for the best. Yeah. So that's a good end of the show, Andreas. So
absolutely. Okay, Michael. So that's it. We will be back soon. Subscribe to our newsletter, podcast, YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. You'll find all the links in the show notes. We're looking forward to your feedback. hello@cloudonow.io or find us on LinkedIn and Mastodon. Thanks for watching. Bye.
Yeah, bye. Have a great day.